News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on News Talk 580 KMJ. Also, remember it's airing on the FM side at 105.9 at 5 p.m. on Saturdays now. You can also catch it online at kmjnow.com. And each week we visit with World War II veterans. We want to honor them for serving, for the sacrifices that they've made for our freedom. We want to preserve their stories for posterity and along the way learn a thing or two about what it means to really love your country. And one thing I love about the Valley is the way we honor our history around here. No one has done that better than our Japanese-American community. And on February the 19th, just a little more than a week ago, the Japanese-American Citizens League got together with a lot of supporters in Clovis. 732 people showed up for the 70th anniversary of Executive Order 9066. Remembrance Day is marked each year in the Japanese-American community because Executive Order 9066 sent all the Japanese-Americans here in the Valley and throughout the West Coast to those internment camps. 70 years later, we had a special Valley honoring of the Congressional Gold Medal presentation. Our guest today was also in Washington, D.C. for that Congressional Gold Medal. I want to give credit where credit is due to the local ceremony, and we'll hear from our guest about it. But they were able to congratulate these living Nisei veterans. 46 living veterans and their spouses were there and had their lunches paid for. There were also complimentary meals and medals given to the surviving spouses of 59 deceased Japanese-American veterans. 473 known Nisei veterans, living or deceased, were honored by their name and service unit in the program. A wonderful day in Clovis on February 19th, and we're going to hear about that and what preceded it with our guest today, Clarence Suzuki, 87 years old. And you're not from the Valley. Most of those people that were there on February 19th for this day of remembrance were around here when World War II broke out. You were a little closer to the start of America's involvement in World War II than just about anyone I've talked to. Where were you on December 7th, 1941?
I was in Honolulu, Hawaii, when the bombs started falling. I was there.
What did that feel like? I mean, because I've talked to guys who were in the service already at that point, and for them, they thought it was drills, it was maneuvers. They weren't that surprised until they saw the rising sun on the side of those Japanese planes. For you, when did you realize that something crazy was going on?
Well, that morning, I was going to Bible training class roughly on the corner of Macaulay and King Street in Honolulu. And the Bible training class was about 9:30, and I was at my friend's house about a block away from the church, I think about 8:30 maybe, something like that. And then I heard a big bomb explosion about a block away. This was on the corner of King Street and Macaulay Street, and it was anchored by the Miyamoto department store and maybe around 10 other stores along King Street. So after the blast, we were kind of shook up what's going on, so we ran outside and kind of looked, and there was smoke. Shortly thereafter, the fire department showed up, and then within 5 minutes, the block was on fire. It's spreading through all the stores. It burned the whole place down. But there was the fireman that carried a woman out, and she had a baby with her in her arms, but she was bleeding. And then that was my first exposure to what happened on that day, December 7th. But the fireman told us to go home and just stay there and listen to the radio. So I went home.
Well, and for people who haven't visited Honolulu, I'm just picturing in my mind, now Pearl Harbor is a couple miles west of what you're talking about. These are the streets of Honolulu, closer to Waikiki, just north of the beaches of Waikiki. In fact, I'll never look at that intersection the same now that you've told me that story. So this is not where all the boats or anything are. This is far away from what the attacks there. Had you had any indication before that something like this could happen? How big of a shock was it?
Well, in 1940, I think my recollection may not be historically correct, but during the summer of 1941, you know, now and then we were out to Waikiki Beach. Next door was Kuhio Beach. Waikiki was for the tourists, Kuhio Beach was for the locals. But during the summer, maybe twice a week, we'd be out there swimming. And I would notice that the aircraft carriers were out there on the horizon. Sometimes three, sometimes none. But my understanding in 1941 summer was the islands were on red alert already. And if you, read about December 7th, there's no acknowledgement that the islands were on red alert. But my recollection is that we were on red alert, namely because in the summer of 1940, Rear Admiral, he was one of the intelligence chiefs in Washington, but he said that Japan might attack Pearl Harbor. But in June of 1941, he says Japan is most likely to attack Pearl Harbor. So that's the kind of historic, background that I have. But most of the media never acknowledged that the islands were on red alert.
Well, I guess it probably wasn't politically expedient at the time because they wanted it to play out as a sneak attack, and that would get America together in a different way. I'm curious, as someone who was Japanese-American living on the island of Oahu, did you know immediately that it was Imperial Japan that had attacked? And did it strike you that this might be tough to be a Japanese-American on that island after the attacks?
Yes. After I saw the explosion and the fire on McCully and King, the firemen told us to go home, stay there. So within a couple of days, message from the authorities was to stay indoors, don't turn on the lights at night. But it turns out that everybody wondered what happened on the McCully and King fire, explosion and fire. As it turned out, Pearl Harbor anti-aircraft guns were shooting at the planes, and some of the shells did not detonate as they were supposed to up in the air. They came down on the ground and exploded. And the same thing was in the city of Honolulu. My understanding was about 260 civilians were killed by our own artillery fire, the bombs exploding in the city of Honolulu.
And you came, I guess, fairly close to being another one added to that tally. How far away were you from these explosions and that fire?
Oh, that fire in McCully, I was only about a block away. Pretty close. See, because I was going to the Olivet Baptist Church for Bible training, but we had to go early and meet at my friend's house, and that was the location that was so close to the bomb. But the church was only another block, Mauka, north, where we were meeting at the Suemori's house.
So in the wake of this, I mean, and as America found out, and everyone who I've ever interviewed has a memory of how they first found out about these attacks, you found out before just about anybody because you were right there. But in the weeks and the months that followed, what was life like there? And when did you realize that your life might end up changing a little bit?
Well, we just had to stay indoors. The instructions were coming over the radio that you should, dig a bomb shelter. And every home would be supplied with some lumber or whatever to make a bomb shelter. So my father and I, we had to pick and shovel in the front yard to build a bomb shelter. But it was kind of messy too because, all that, dirt and stuff like that, and you had to have lumber to cover up the sort of a tunnel that you dug, just barely, enough for a couple of three people. After that, you had to put black cloth over the windows, and you couldn't have any light shining at night. But we managed. We got some black cloth and some low incandescent lamps. We managed to be in a blackout. And then the school said, yeah, we're going to be school coming out. But this was now around February of 1942. So all the kids went back to school. From that point on, I think the military was, getting more and more secure about Japan not attacking and landing in the Hawaiian Islands.
And that's the thing. I don't want to look past that because we know now that Japan didn't come back and conquer the islands as they might have been able to had they struck at the right time. But it must have been a constant state of fear for you there, having seen what they did on December 7th, that they might come back. How did you deal with that?
Well, we all worried about that, that the Japan armed forces might return. But in the meantime, the military governor, General Emmons, allowed the University of Hawaii ROTC guys to form the Victory Volunteer Soldiers. And there was another group of Niseis that were already in the U.S. Army. They got booted out. And there was another group in the Territorial Guard. So these three groups formed later on the nucleus of the 100th Infantry Battalion. School started, and we tried to get back to normalcy, but things were not normal. I mean, we didn't have the regular teachers. My teacher, Dr. Daiho Chan, he was a major, and he didn't come back to school because he had an ROTC commission. And we had another teacher called Mrs. Evans. She was not up to snuff. But we managed to, you know, go through all this period. And I graduated from McKinley High School in 1943. At that time, they were asking for volunteers. And I asked my papa, and he said, no, don't go. But the others, they went, like Senator, you know, Dan Inouye. He was a year older than me. I think he was in the university already, but he volunteered. And some of my classmates volunteered also. They became the nucleus of the 442nd. And I met Senator Inouye in Washington.
At this recent Congressional Gold Medal Ceremony in November?
November 2nd, they had kind of a impromptu pre-dinner, you know, get-together. So I met Senator Inouye at the time. And I told Senator, you know, you were in McCulley and Bingham Track, and I was in McCulley down on Date Street. And he opened his eyes and said, oh, you know, he didn't say anything. I said, no, you know, Dan, you were in the Troop 36, the Boy Scouts of America, and we met at the YMCA once a month. And Dan only smiled and, you know, he didn't say anything. And then I told Dan, hey, you know, when I went to the university after the war, his wife, Margaret Aramura, was in the teacher's department or whatever, and she was administering the English, spoken English test. So I passed, but my wife Thelma flunked. She had to go to speech lab. But I mentioned that all. I said, Dan, you know, I also know that some of your, you know, guys in the 442 were my classmates. One was Thomas Jichaku. He was killed in action in Anzio. And Shigeru Kanemoto, he was with Dan earlier, I guess, but I don't know what outfit he was in. Then there's Archie Soken, my classmate, also Flash Nakagawa. I don't know what happened to these guys, too. Dan only smiled. He never said anything.
He probably got a lot of those conversations that week in Washington. But what I hear, and so you had been in the same Boy Scout troop with him all these years before, and it sounds like you were just saying that you thought about joining at a time where you would have ended up in the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. That's not what your destiny would be in the military. We'll talk about that in a minute. But have you ever wondered how different your life would have been had you ended up with the 442nd?
Yeah, I often wondered about that because, you know, the guys that went in there, they took some heavy, you know, getting killed and everything. I often thought about that too. I said I was fortunate that, in a way, I didn't go to Europe, but instead it's because of my language training that after I took my basic training in Skofia Barracks, they had a Japanese language school established there. Most people didn't know.
And what you didn't know at the time was that your performance in that school might have ended up saving your life by sparing you a potentially more dangerous assignment at the tail end of World War II. We'll get to that when we come back. Clarence Suzuki, 87 years old, a native of Hawaii, but now a fixture here in the San Joaquin Valley, is our guest today. We'll hear about what he did in the Military Intelligence Service and also what it meant to him to be awarded the Congressional Gold Medal and take part in ceremonies both in Washington, D.C., and right here in the San Joaquin Valley in Clovis. Hometown Heroes will continue after I tell you a little bit about Fresno Distributing, where the 5-day mega sale event starts this coming Tuesday on McKinley between Blackstone and the 41.
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno T.
I
can remember hearing that jingle on the radio for years, but I didn't really understand what it meant until redoing my shower a couple years ago. This is Paul Leffler, proud to welcome Fresno Distributing as a sponsor of Hometown Heroes here on KMJ. The knucklehead who tiled my shower, that would be yours truly, left a decent-sized hole around the shower arm. I needed an oversized flange to cover it, and I went all over town. None of the chain stores had what I needed. Finally, a merciful soul asked me, "Have you tried Fresno D?" Fresno D, as in duh, why didn't I think of that in the first place? So I quickly took the 41 of the McKinley exit, walked into Fresno Distributing, and bumped smack dab into the owner, Steve Cloud. He said he was sure they had exactly what I needed, and of course, he was right. Now I make Fresno D my first stop, whether I'm looking for one of those obscure plumbing parts or a top-of-the-line appliance, like the new Electrolux energy-efficient washer and dryer set my wife picked out. They have all the other top brands, too. Don't make the mistake I did. If you want your first stop to be your last stop, make a beeline for Fresno D. And while you're there, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K through 12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. When we left off, Clarence Suzuki had told us about his experiences as a teenager on Oahu and how he experienced the attacks of December 7th, 1941. How when some of his contemporaries joined the 442nd Regimental Combat Team in what was a segregated U.S. military in World War II, Clarence chose not to do that at the time. The 442nd, of course, would go on to achieve fame as the go-for-broke unit in Europe, suffering extreme casualties while making a giant impact. But different plans were in store for Clarence. He told us how much time he had spent studying the Japanese language as a young man, and how the military had him in a language school on Oahu to see how he might be able to contribute to the Allied war effort. Let's pick up the story there now with 87-year-old Clarence Suzuki.
But this language school, I attended about a month, and then this Navy Lieutenant J.G. came by, and he was interviewing a lot of the guys that was in the school, and I apparently passed the language test because I was the only guy that he sent me to Tinian. The rest of them went to Okinawa. But it's because of my spoken language proficiency. Before the war, I went to 8th grade in a Japanese language school. It was for at least 1.5 hours after English school. So it was basically 3 o'clock to about 5 o'clock, plus 3 hours on Saturday morning. So I had a good command of the spoken language. But the kanji, the Chinese characters, I wasn't that good at. But the Navy was looking for people that could speak the language. See, we had to, interrogate, interpret.
And I don't want to make a leap here, but as I just think about this in retrospect and know where you did end up, and not that it was a cakewalk what you experienced, but if you didn't have those language skills, if you hadn't been that dedicated in your schoolwork and learning the Japanese language and other situations, then you might have ended up somewhere else. The language skills you had may have ended up saving your life. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's a fair estimate, because if I didn't pass that test, I would have probably gone overseas, maybe back to Italy or someplace. Sometimes being smart, might be helpful.
You hear that out there, smart guys? Oh, well, so let's talk about what you ended up doing. And people hear a lot about the 442nd, maybe even the 100th. They don't hear as much about the MIS. Tell us what MIS stands for and what kinds of things you did in the MIS.
MIS is Military Intelligence Service. The service was activated during the war from the Presidio of San Francisco. But because of Roosevelt's 9066 that issued on February 19, 1942, that school in the Presidio was closed, and the school moved to Camp Savage in Minnesota. And from there, it was, you know, getting too small. More and more students were coming to the school, so they transferred the students over to Fort Snelling, a bigger place. But I might have ended over there, or I could have ended up in the infantry, you know, gone into some other outfit, not the 442. But because of my language training, I was fortunate. I was sent to Tinian. They flew me on a C-54 with all the officers. I was the only enlisted man on that plane. Flew from Honolulu to Johnson Island to Kwajalein and landed in Guam. From Guam, I took another transport, DC-3, got to Tinian. So I stayed on Tinian as a Navy Japanese language interpreter. This was part of the military government at the time. And I also went to Saipan. But Saipan had a place called Shalankanoa. That's where the Chamorros were. Most of the other Chamorros were on the island of Guam. But the Chamorros were interesting too, because on Saipan I met this guy, Juan Guerrero, and he spoke five languages. He spoke Japanese, he spoke German, because the Germans were there before the Japanese in the Marianas. So he spoke English, he spoke Chamorro, he spoke Spanish. But he had two beautiful daughters.
So you got to know him well, it sounds like. And this, the time where you were in the Saipan and Tinian area, was right after those battles had been fought to win American control of those islands?
I was there after the post-war, you know, period. But we had to take care of the civilians. We also had captured the Japanese soldiers, and there were a few of them running around in the hills. So I carried a Smith & Wesson 38 to be on the safe side. But some of the American soldiers were, you know, sticking their dogs on me. So I said, you know, stop it or I'm going to shoot the damn dogs.
That 38 came in handy. So what did your duties consist of at this time? And what was the strategic importance that you were carrying out?
Well, it was post-war. And the guys that were there earlier were with the 27th Infantry. They're the guys that was probably around 13 people, headed by a Caucasian officer. But one of the guys in that outfit was Dick Kishiwe. He was from Hanford. He just passed away last year. But my duty was part of trying to help the civilians, you know, get back to normalcy. They were in a big camp called Camp Churro. But there was some soldiers hiding in the camps too. They would periodically kill one of their own guys, you know, one of the Japanese civilians, for being out of step with their doctrine. Plus, the ones that were prisoners, they had to be taken care of health-wise too. So we had a field hospital to take care of these people, the civilians and the soldiers. That's what we did on Tinian until they closed the base around April of 1946.
And when did you get there?
I got there August 15th, 1945, just after the war ended.
Right when the war ended, a couple weeks before they signed the treaty. Well, it strikes me, since Tinian was where the Enola Gay took off from to drop the bomb on Hiroshima, where were you when you heard about that, and what was the significance for you?
Well, the bomb was dropped before I landed on Tinian, because I think August 6th and August 9th, I got there August 15th, about, you know, a couple of weeks after the bomb. But, you know, talking to the guys too, I mean, they were all shocked that they had the atom bomb there. We you know, we could go over to the base, Northfield. They had three bomb wings, B-29s. One was on Guam and one on Saipan. But Northfield on Tinian was the big air base. Post-war, I was able to go to the Enola Gay, and I had a picture taken with me in front of the airplane. But all the guys that were there before me, most of the guys were Navy that, you know, I was with. They were shocked, and you say, oh, my God, you know. they didn't know about the bomb. Two bombs, actually. My understanding, talking to these guys, you know, they were bombing Japan for some time already after we took Iwo Jima, the B-29s were already bombing Japan all over. And what they were doing was firebomb Tokyo and all the big cities, Nagoya, Osaka. So by the time August, you know, came around, there was no need to drop a bomb, an atom bomb, because Japan was already ready to surrender. But the emperor didn't come out soon enough, and that's why the first bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. But my understanding is that the bomb was not intended for Hiroshima. It was intended for Kurei. Kurei was a naval base, big one, right north of Hiroshima. But because it was all clouded over, they couldn't see the target. So they kept going south, and then there's Hiroshima, and it's all clear. So my understanding is, say, hey, you know, why not drop the bomb there already? Get the hell out of there. But the same thing happened on August 9th on Nagasaki. The intended target was, forgot the naval base. Yeah, it was on the island of Kyushu, right across from Honshu. But that was also a big naval base. That's where the bomb was supposed to be dropped. But it was clouded over. They went down south. They passed another naval base, Sasebo. That was also clouded over. Then they came towards the Nagasaki, and there it's all bright and clear. Drop the damn thing. Get out of here. So, I mean, you know, this is what I think happened. Mm-hmm. There's no way I can prove that that's true.
Do you feel, I know you say you felt the Imperial Japan was ready to surrender before that, but do you feel that that sped up the end of the war and maybe spared you from some other situations you might have encountered?
Yeah, I think personally that President Truman made the right decision based on what the military was telling him. If they didn't drop the bomb, we had to go in, there would be so many U.S. soldiers there, so many Japanese soldiers, and both sides would have taken huge losses. The estimate was maybe the U.S. would lose 510,000 men. Japanese would lose maybe 2 million. So if Olympia went through and then continued on, it would have gone into the island of Honshu, and more people would have got killed. So what President Truman saw was it was the right thing to do to end the war with the bomb, atom bomb. By doing that, he saved so many million lives. And that's my understanding why the bomb was dropped in the first place.
Absolutely. And I want to speak to your specific experience once the war ended, because most of your work was still to come. But in the time from when you entered the Army to the war ended, and you hadn't been deployed there to the Marianas yet or any of that, but what was it like for you to be in the military? What was your motivation? And did you feel that you had to prove the fact that you were an American because of your ancestry, because you were Japanese-American, and that all these other folks are in internment camps across the country? Did you feel like you had something to prove because of your heritage?
Not really, Paul. You know why? Because, you know, we're in Hawaii. Hawaii had a majority population of Japanese, 35% of the population compared to on the mainland 1%. So we were not treated like the ones that were treated on the mainland. So we didn't have all that prejudice that the ones on the mainland experienced.
So you didn't feel that prejudice personally, but were you aware of the situation that other Japanese Americans were facing at the time?
Yes, I was aware of the problems on the mainland Japanese, but in Hawaii were different. And my recollection is that the islanders and the mainlanders, on, you know, while they were basic training, they had their differences, because in Hawaii we spoke Pidgin English, and on the mainland they spoke the King's English. So doing basic training and Camp Shelby, they were fighting each other. But for us, you know, we never had to go to the mainland, so we never experienced all the mainland guys speaking their King's English. But in Hawaii, we have our unique language, and, you know, it's kind of a mixture of several different cultures and languages. But only the Hawaiians can speak this Pidgin. Like I tell you, Paul, go stay go, is it go or stay?
And I say, what?
Go stay go means go. I come on by, right? I come on by. I come by and by. I mean, that's all that English, but it's our own version.
I've heard some of that pidgin in Hawaii, and I don't usually understand it, but I do speak Malasada.
Yeah.
So the work that you did as a translator, interpreter, and interrogator, first there on Saipan and Tinian, how aware were you of what had happened there? The thing that jumps out at me for Saipan is that suicide cliff where so many Japanese were deceived into taking their own lives, even their children's lives. Is that something that became clear to you at the time as you talked to some of the locals in their language?
Yeah, actually, I was there after the war, so I don't know too much what happened, but I read about it. So there's a Hawaiian guy, Kubo. He was kind of a brave soldier. He was with the 27th Infantry. He would go into a cave where there were some holdout soldiers, but the soldiers were keeping some civilians hostage too. So he went in several times, unarmed, try to get some 20 soldiers to surrender. The third time out, he finally got the right message to them, and he told the soldiers, don't die for the emperor, stay alive for your family. So that's what turned them over to his side, and they surrendered, and then all the civilians came behind them. Bob Kubo also got the information that there was going to be a gyokusai. Gyokusai is the suicide banzai charge, and it would be in a couple of days. Yeah, this was before the end of the war, and it was still in 1944. But Bob Kubo was able to get the information that there's going to be this gyokusai, and he related to his commanding officers, and they got ready for that gyokusai charge, and they wiped them all out. But because of Bob's bravery, he got the soldiers to surrender and got the information about the gyokusai. He was awarded the Distinguished Service Medal, the third highest, you know, award. But he's the only Nisei in the Pacific that I know had won a, you know, honor like a, you know, Distinguished Service Medal. Most of the other guys, like Dick Kishiwe, was a 27th Infantry, same outfit. He only got the probably a Bronze Star Combat Infantry badge. But most of the other guys, they never got anything.
And many Nisei veterans of World War II died without ever receiving the recognition they deserved. But this past November, you were among those who were in Washington, D.C. to receive the Congressional Gold Medal, along with scores of other Japanese-American World War II veterans. You also took part in that special ceremony February 19th in Clovis, and let's get to that when we come back. 87-year-old Clarence Suzuki served in the Military Intelligence Service in World War II. We'll hear more from him when Hometown Heroes continues after I tell you about some of our sponsors like Ming's, where I had an unbelievable meal last week, and Fresno Distributing, where that mega sale starts Tuesday. What do you think of when I say Fresno D? Probably that catchy little jingle, right?
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
Paul Leffler here to tell you what it means to me. It means Fresno Distributing's selection of top-of-the-line appliances at wholesale prices for you, me, and everybody means you don't have to go anywhere else. Since I started hosting Bulldog Coaches shows in Fresno D's showroom a few years back, I've gotten to know the owner, Steve Cloud, quite well. I know that some of his favorites are King Tut, Coca-Cola with real sugar in it, and of course, the Bulldogs. I know not to challenge him in gin rummy because he's a former world champion, no joke. But the other thing I know, and here's why my wife and I picked out our new Electrolux washer and dryer there, I know the Cloud family has been carrying the best appliances you can find anywhere since 1946. Bosch, Frigidaire, Maytag, Jennair, KitchenAid, Wolf, you name it. They have it. Don't just take my word for it. Go see for yourself at Fresno Distributing on McKinley between Blackstone and 41. Plumbing, lighting, electrical, kitchen, bath, whatever you need, Fresno D has it. And you won't find friendlier or more knowledgeable service anywhere. A locally owned business with great prices, great selection, and great service. Why go anywhere else? Still as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting this week with 87-year-old Clarence Suzuki, who served in the Military Intelligence Service during World War II. He is one of the Nisei veterans who received the Congressional Gold Medal in Washington, D.C., also took part in the local ceremony here in Clovis that we're going to talk some more about here momentarily. If you missed the beginning of the show, you missed Clarence telling us how, as a teenager on Oahu, he experienced the attacks on Pearl Harbor firsthand in downtown Honolulu. You also heard how he ended up in the Army, how his skills with the Japanese language led him to a job with the Military Intelligence Service, and he's told us some of what that entailed. We're going to pick it up now with what he did after World War II ended. I do want to remind you that you can see pictures of our guest today, Clarence Suzuki, and his lovely wife, Thelma, on our website at kmjnow.com. You can also visit the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. There's even that photo that you may have heard Clarence mention that he took posing in front of the Enola Gay, because the island of Tinian was one of the places that he was stationed at the end of World War II. Let's pick it up now with what happened to Clarence after the war ended and where the military decided to send him.
I got stuck in Tinian after the outfit. I was the Navy outfit. They closed shop around April of 46. So I was put back into the Army Island Command, and that's when I re-enlisted. I was on Saipan for about 2 months just to get home. And with all that lousy chow, and sometimes the chow ran out, so we didn't have anything to eat for dinner. But finally got to Hawaii, and I spent about a vacation 1 month. After my 1 month leave, I got to Japan, General MacArthur's headquarters. The so-called Allied Translator Interpreter Service was anchored in the NYK building in Tokyo, very close to the Daiichi building where General MacArthur was headquartered. We were billeted in the sixth floor, and we did the interrogations on the first floor. I was sent to Maizuru on the Japan Sea, sort of in the Kyoto area. And I think it was the former Japan Navy officers school or something, maybe equivalent to the Naval Academy in Annapolis. So we had breakfast and dinner and lunch, all with tablecloth and silver, and didn't have to make our bed in the morning. So we were treated like officers, but I was a sergeant. But we were screening the guys that came back, the POWs that were captured by the Russians. They were shipped from Nakhodka on the Siberian coast. And we were screening them for military intelligence. And the ones that had more information potentially, we called them back to Tokyo for further interrogation. So I spent all my time there interrogating, but some things I said, would not be appropriate because I don't know whether it's classified or not.
Well, I think, isn't there like a 50-year period before it gets unclassified?
No, I don't know, because some of this stuff, might still be classified.
Now everybody's ears are perking up.
Yeah, well, basically, these guys came from Nakhodka along with the POWs. There was another guy. He was the head of the Japanese Communist Party. He was exiled before the war, and he was with the Chinese 8th Route Army. And then he went to Moscow, and his name was Nozaka Sanzo. And he also had the secretary of the Communist Party with him, Tokuda. But they both came back to Maizuru, but MacArthur's program was to allow them in, a free democracy, so you could have Communist Party in Japan. But I didn't interrogate those guys. one of the soldiers.
Basically, you're trying to find out what the Russians were doing up there and what plans they may have to expand their territory in that part of the world?
Yeah, well, we weren't getting along with the Russians post-war, World War II, and the Russians took a lot of the rail out of Manchuria and they put it as a backup to the Trans-Siberian Railway. Someplace around Irkutsk, Lake Baikal, they put another rail line behind the Trans-Siberian Rail as a kind of backup rail line. The interrogations actually was more towards Vladivostok and Khabarovsk. Khabarovsk was the Siberian headquarters of the Russian army.
I'm curious, as I try to put myself in your shoes, you've just experienced this worldwide war. You were there on Oahu the day America was drawn into the war. You're in the Pacific when it comes to an end and afterwards. And now, after all of that, you're getting all this intelligence. Could you see what was coming? Did you have an idea that there was going to be the kind of global tension that would exist not too long after that between America and the USSR?
I had no idea what would happen after I left the service. But beyond my military service, I kept reading about the historic background, what's happening. And I think President Roosevelt was kind of going downhill when he agreed with Stalin on the Yalta Agreement and also the Potsdam Agreement. But both of those agreements, the Russians made out because in Berlin, I think the General Patton's army was there right at the Elbe River, but they couldn't cross over to go into Berlin because of that agreement that Roosevelt made with Stalin. So those Russians took Berlin, and we had the Berlin problem. And same thing happened to Korea because of Roosevelt's giving in to Stalin. The Russians came in early part of August 1945, and within 2 weeks they were down to the 38th parallel of Korea. And we still got a war with them going on.
And you would obviously be aware of global tensions throughout your career. You went back to school after the war. You ended up working not just in Silicon Valley in the early days, but before that on laser technology and research and development. I'm curious, though, when you finally got out of the military, you got to go on with your life as a student at the University of Hawaii, meet your wife, Thelma. You guys have been married 62 years now. Did you have a sense of relief that that chapter of your life was over? Did you have a sense of accomplishment? How would you describe your approach to life after you got out of the service?
Well, I think I served my country as best as I could under the circumstances that I was in. If I could have done more, I would have. But because of the situation in Hawaii, I chose not to volunteer for the 442nd in 1943. But some of my friends did. I think I did my best for whatever duties that were assigned to me. And post-war, I made a contribution to the economy because of my contributions in the high-tech industry. This was my payback to the country that I served that gave me the opportunity to have served in the first place. And secondly, to give me the education that I got that got me to where I am today.
It was with the GI Bill that you got a bachelor's and a master's?
Yes, that's the best thing that happened to me. Otherwise, I couldn't have gotten to college.
And I don't want to fast forward too far here, but running short on time in the program, I want to hear about what it meant to you to go to Washington, D.C. You already talked about meeting Senator Inouye there, but to have that Congressional Gold Medal ceremony and to see these leaders of our country say, "We honor you and all the other Japanese Americans who served during World War II." What did that mean to you? What was that experience like?
It was a once-in-a-lifetime experience. The last chapter in my life history, I am so honored to have been able to have gone to the U.S. Congress and be in the Emancipation Hall where the Speaker of the House honored us, as well as all the senators, all the people that were there, my comrades in arms.
You told me that the ceremony here, just this past February 19th on the 70th anniversary of Executive Order 9066, that ceremony at the Clovis Veterans Memorial Building was even more impressive and more meaningful to you than that ceremony in our nation's capital. Why was that? What was so special about this local observance?
Yeah, the local JACL sponsored this event, and it was unique. The World War II veterans honored individually, and we formed the line going up, and they call our names, and we were, you know, thanked, and we were put up in a stage for all the audience to see us. So that was the unique part of the ceremony. Was in Washington, D.C., we got the Congressional Gold Medal from a desk. They just issued the gold medal to us from a desk. You signed up on a, you know, list there, and they check you off, and they gave you the medal. So that wasn't too good in a way. But in Clovis, we was individually honored. But I already had the medal in Washington, so they gave me an empty box.
Now you ruined the illusion for everybody that was there that day. When you look at that medal, and it's prominently displayed here in the entryway to your home, when you see it there, what does it mean to you? What does it signify for you?
Yeah, it signifies that the U.S. citizens have honored us for our service during World War II, and it's a proud thing to have received that honor, because over all these years, I think the Nisei were not recognized by most of the Americans that didn't know what we contributed during World War II. So in that respect, I am so thankful for all the citizens in the United States through their congresspeople for honoring us for our service.
And obviously also those here for the local ceremony. And you hit on that, and it brings up one more point. You talk about it not being recognized, and if there is anything about Japanese-American history in World War II that has been recognized, it's the tragedy of the internment, obviously, and the work of the 442nd. But your outfit, the MIS, is often overlooked, and I'm curious how many times you've told someone where you served in World War II, and they gave you a funny look. Do you ever run into people that didn't even know Japanese-Americans were in the Pacific in World War II?
Yeah, most of my friends didn't know that the MIS was in the Pacific, namely because until the Freedom of Information Act 1976, most people didn't know we were out there in the Pacific, attached to the Marines, attached to the Army, attached to the Australian, British armies, Indian Army. More recently, information is coming out that we were out there. We were in every major battle in the Pacific. Most Americans know the 442 served in Italy and France, but I would say only 10% of the Americans know that the Nisei were out in the Pacific in every major battle.
Well, hopefully we're helping a few more people understand that today. Well, as we wrap up the show, I just want to thank you for serving our country, and thank you for sharing some of those stories with us.
Thank you very much, Paul. I appreciate you interrogating me.
The tables are turned.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. The pleasure has been all mine. 87-year-old Clarence Suzuki of Fresno, California, served in the MIS, the Military Intelligence Service, during World War II. And he talked about how much that local Remembrance Day ceremony meant to him. Just to tell you again how special that was, I have some of the statistics from that event. It was sponsored, of course, by the Clovis Veterans Memorial District, who welcomed all the Nisei veterans and their families there. Meals and medals for veterans were sponsored by the Nisei Farmers League and the Sun-Made Growers. If you didn't hear it earlier, 473 names, 473 known Nisei veterans, living and deceased, were honored by name and service unit on six pages in the middle of a beautiful program that day. The names of those killed in action were read, and that was followed by a 21-gun salute. They presented flags to the families and, of course, played taps to honor all the deceased veterans. And, of course, the living Nisei veterans and their families were there as well. It was a wonderful day in Clovis. And it's not the first time something this special has happened in our Japanese-American community. It won't be the last time either. And I hope maybe that you've learned a little bit, as I have today. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes right here on KMJ.
Back to Saipan Tinian, Bob Kubo was one of 13 guys, I think, 13 or 14. But they left the Marianas, and I think they went to the Philippines after that. But the Philippines is another story. I don't know too much what happened there, but the story goes there was an important Japan Navy document that fell into American hands, was flown to Australia. Because of the information being translated, we won the Battle of Leyte. We beat the Japanese Navy, the final naval encounter during World War II.
So, and I've had sailors on this program who were involved in that battle, and we've heard the story of that battle, but what you're saying is, without the information gleaned by Japanese Americans serving in the MIS and translating a captured Japanese document, that the American victory there might not have unfolded quite the way it did.
Yeah, that's true, because most of the Niseis were in Australia, in Brisbane, and they were the translator group. They were the Allied Translator and Interpreter Service at this. Most of the captured documents, if you were in the field, in the Philippines or in the Marianas or whatever, you had no time to do any translation. And most of the guys, you know, didn't have that much of a translator background. They were more interrogators, interpreters. So most of the translation of documents went to Australia.
So you had guys who could orally understand and interrogate, but when it came to translating the written word, that wasn't their strong suit.
No, it wasn't their strong suit. And like myself, I have limited translation abilities, but I have a dictionary that I could use to translate. But it would take me 1 hour to translate a one-page document. Whereas the guys that are proficient, they would translate a document, you know, within 10 minutes.
In terms of your service, after World War II ended, you are in these areas, and I think I heard you allude to earlier the fact that while you're on these islands, there are still Japanese soldiers who don't realize that the war's over?
Yeah, that's true. The Tinian, you know, they had a few stragglers, and they're hiding out, and some of them were actually hiding out in the civilian camps. And they did some damage because they would kill anybody that was pro-American. There was a Navy officer, Lieutenant Riff Snyder. He was part of a missionary family, and he grew up in Japan knowing the language. So he was the officer in charge of the prison camp for the soldiers. The ones that were loose out in the fields, they were in the civilian camps too, as well as out in the caves. Maybe 10, 15 of them were still out in the hills.
There's some famous stories of some guys still being up there years and years later, not realizing that it was over and not believing it. Huh?
Yeah, there was an article not too long ago, maybe a couple of days ago. There was a soldier that finally surrendered in the Philippines, sergeant, I think, and he had about 10 guys with him. And slowly but surely, they were all being killed or they passed away. But he was the last holdout in the Philippines, a former general of the Philippine-Japanese Army. He was able to contact this guy, and he finally surrendered after all these years.
Like just recently?
Yeah, just recently.
Wow, that's unbelievable.